and his name is Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. I'd like to just say a few words to stir it up a little bit. All of you folks sitting in the back, standing in the back, you'll be glad to know that there are a couple of tables down here that are reserved for people who didn't show up. I'm not judging, I'm just telling you. So you know, I know you don't mind standing as long as you know that. But we are, one of the hallmarks of this particular get-together, and it isn't anybody's fault, and I know Shirali is not a fan of it, but everything is saved all the time. Everywhere you go, something has been, you went to that pool at 6 in the morning, it's already been saved since 5, and then they go back to bed and stay there till 2 in the afternoon. There's never anybody uses the seats, but they're always saved, and people say to me, isn't that unjust? I say, I have no opinion. I've given up fighting all things and all people. But we're here today. This is not really a regular meeting. We've had some excellent speakers, and we have more excellent speakers coming. And this is not a regular meeting. This is just kind of a discussion. One of Billy's Shady Bunch group. And I've been asked to say a few words about a disease of perception, which is just a little bit about the misconceptions that many people come here with and maintain after they get to AA, and what happens to people who look at AA and wonder why it is the way it is. You know, I guess it would be safe to say, although it is never formally written down anywhere, but that there probably at least are 3 or more types of alcoholics. And they are confusing to one and all because they seem the same, but they look different. You see some drunken people, and they all look the same. But there seem to be at least 3 different types of alcoholics. One would be an alcoholic who drinks like an alcoholic and drinks to excess and drinks too much. And he gets to a point in his life or her life where something really threatening or dramatic happens, a death in the family or a loss of a home or a loss of a very long time job or the loss of relationships or something. And this shocks that drinker into stopping drinking. And there are many, many cases of these kind of cases where they drank a great deal, but then when something really traumatic happened, they stopped. That's one type of alcoholic, I guess. And another type of alcoholic would be another drunk who becomes not only emotionally addicted, but becomes physiologically addicted to alcohol, and they find it very, very difficult to withdraw them from alcohol. Incidentally, I don't know if anyone knows this or ever thinks about this, but withdrawal from alcoholism is about 10 times as lethal as the withdrawal from drugs, any drug. Has been said before, you put 30 drug addicts in a room and leave them there for a few days, and you come back and you find an awful lot of sick people. But if you put 30 advanced alcoholics in a room and come back in a few days, you find a lot of sick people and some dead people. Ha ha ha, not very funny. But because the withdrawal from alcohol is really rather difficult. And that's these people who become severely physiologically addicted usually require, and many times require, some degree of hospitalization, as they did in Bill Wilson's day, as they did before that and after that. Where they, it sounds kind of peculiar now to young people, but in the early days of AA, in fact, when I started going to AA, when people went on 12-step calls, they took a pint of whiskey with them to help the guy get off, to give him a couple of drinks so he would not go into those convulsions. I see people in my job now go into convulsions quite often. I see different people, not the same person, though, quite often. And it really is a terrible thing. It's a kind of a really bright spot about it is the only person it doesn't affect is the person having the convulsion. To him, he just faints. But everybody around him, those terrible, terrible spasms. But these people have to go to hospitals, be physiologically withdrawn. And that's, I think, one of the, how some of the hospitals today Sheikh Seidel, I think of, at least I guess they still do, I know they used to, talk about how they can cure alcoholism in 7 days with a couple of follow-ups. And they literally do that. You go to the hospital and they give you excellent treatment and you get off and you are now aware of the terribleness of what you've been in and you have some follow-ups and you're off. That's a different type of alcoholic. They are withdrawn and they are made aware of the intensity of their problem. And then there's the other type of alcoholic, which you're just whispering all day long here. Then there's the other type of alcoholic, and it seems to me improve people like me, I presume like most of you who are here. And they're the people who drink also just like everybody else. Some become physically addicted, some don't. But they're eventually sobered up, taken off alcohol, made aware of the intensity of their problem, become involved in the deep difficulty they're located in, and despite all this, sooner or later, must always eventually drink again. Much to the surprise of everybody around them, much to the people who, surprise the people who love them, people who depend on them, and more importantly, much to the surprise of the patient himself or herself. And that has always been the great puzzle. And I guess for most people around, people like you and me, they look at these other types of alcoholics and say, look, my Uncle Fred, he once upon a time drank as bad as you did, but when it got bad, he quit. Can't you quit? And people like me have quit, only to drink again. And you hear someone say, if you just go through this hospital program, go to this withdrawal, as I did in another place, another city, I went through the withdrawal in the hospital, and I came out and determined I was going to be all right for my children's sake, if nothing else. And much to my surprise, and everyone else's surprise, I drank again. And it just gets to be baffling, that ridiculous analogy they use in the big book about this jaywalker, it's really that ridiculous to people around us. I mean, why would you do that? And there's no answer. The only answer I do, the only effective answer when you really get cornered is, let me alone, leave me alone. Leave me alone, you don't understand. So for thousands of years, there have been people getting off alcohol because of trauma. Some have gotten off because of physical help. And then there's been this vast preponderance of people like you and me who don't get off, who get off and get on and get off and get on. And in the last 5 or 6 thousand years, as long as there's been regular usage of alcohol, there's always been people like us, and it's always been a bafflement to everyone. And one time they used to put them to death because they thought they were possessed with the devil. And they're flogged and flayed and sent away. I was down in Australia this week, earlier this week. They were talking about this whole penal colony that started out in Botany Bay. Most of them were long-term alcoholics from England, creating crimes, and with the addition of their term of drinking, and send them over there. Don't let them ever come back to England, because there's no cure for these people. And so you think, well, now AA has been formed, and now there's a way out, because we understand this. I don't think Bill Wilson, I think, intuitively understood it. He didn't really have as much knowledge as anybody in this room has, because there just wasn't that much knowledge available. But throughout the book, he seems to mention that phrase that, as he's kind of groped to define it, alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics, he doesn't mention any other types, but there just seem to be alcoholics of our type. And it's kind of funny because even in the 63 years of Alcoholics Anonymous existence, and the only successful therapy for alcoholics on a long-term basis, there was a short one, of course, in the 1840s, the Washingtonians, but they stopped helping alcoholics, they started helping narcotics addicts and stamping out the use of alcohol and got in politics, and they all died drunk. But this is the only long-term effectual program for alcoholics, and yet people cannot accept it today and haven't been able to accept it for years and years. I look back at just the years I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous. In the 1950s, it's kind of amusing some of the efforts people make to try to avoid the type of abstinence we offer with involved action. In the 1950s, it was the first time, I think, that there really was any feeling in the late 1940s that there was something about drinking, these drinking problems, that had some medical background. And most of us are familiar that in the early 1950s, It was a great surprise to the medical community when they decided to give AA the Lasker Award for the greatest advance in public health. And that was 1951, I guess. And then in the early 1952, they thought, once and for all, let's get rid of, let's find out what alcoholism is, help these people, and get rid of it. And they started an immense school of alcoholic studies at Yale University. And they really went all out to once and for all extinguish it. It's like you'd try to understand pneumonia or AIDS or something. Something just get them understanding. And they studied all kinds of drunks from all over, and all kinds of people, non-alcoholics in there. They had all people of all sorts of social backgrounds and economic backgrounds and all sorts of patterns. You know, they'd give them tests. They'd give an non-alcoholic a couple drinks, and then a non-alcoholic a couple drinks, and see if they could determine any difference in their reaction. I thought that would be a great test to be in, wouldn't it? Yeah. Hey, here's your drink. Have another one. Thanks, so what if I do? That's all for today.
Bullshit it is.
But they did all kinds of psychological testing, all kinds of testing. They wanted to report this thing. In fact, they continued that school of alcoholic studies, moved to Rutgers University. Later, I guess at one point or the other, still in existence. They have a school of alcoholic studies at the University of Utah. But they really had a long report. And I did not read the report all the way through. I glanced at a summation of it, and someone else gave me an even more summation, concise summation. But as far as I could determine, they really found nothing that all these alcoholics had in common. The non-alcoholics. They found two things that they seemed to have in common, and they seemed to have, they couldn't understand any reason for that. One thing is that the non-alcoholics seemed to have a different psychological profile on their testing after they drank. And that shouldn't be. You should have just the same psychological profile, maybe a little bit different, but not a changed person. And secondly, they all ranked in the top 5th percentile of perfectionism, which I don't understand because I've never been a perfectionist. I just want things to be right or screw it. Yeah. That's all right. Anyway, I had this funny study. I got sober, and then some scientists at the University of Saskatchewan in Utah, they're always working hard to help folks. And in the mid to late 1950s, they isolated a chemical which they identified as to be a tremendous help to alcoholics. It would bring about an ability to break through this core of lack of self-understanding or something. And they brought it forth, and they experimented with it. In fact, they sent some of the new chemicals to UCLA. In the end of 1958, early 1959, I think it was December, January, they came down from UCLA to the AA club, behind whose building I was sleeping in an abandoned car, waiting to make my move to Palm Springs. And they wanted 10 volunteers to come out to UCLA and take a new test. It was test as new chemical. And I volunteered like a rocket, you know. Thought maybe I'd get a square meal and a change of clothes. And they looked at me, I didn't have any front teeth, and I had some old clothes I'd been living in for weeks. And I thought they felt I wouldn't give a chemical a fair shake. So they took 10 other people out to UCLA, and I just missed the great January 1959 test of the new chemical LSD. True story. And I thought, if I were getting that test, I could have done something. As you might imagine, I only know two of them ever went back. I only know two of them went back, those 10. And also at that same time, there's something, a guy asked me about this, I was at some place called Alice Springs, which is 1,000 miles from any other town in Australia. It's out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you know, just nowhere. And you think people say, what's the big book? And some guy comes to me and says, what's this about Bill Wilson taking LSD? He said, well, he didn't say it as nicely as I said it. He said, he cursed. But that's interesting. A lot of people, all this, you know, Bill Wilson took LSD. I'll tell you how that happened. because the scientists also convinced him it might be of help to alcoholics. And he decided to try it because there was nobody ahead of him. And he took it under laboratory conditions. He put him in a laboratory, and he took this LSD to see if there was something to help alcoholics. And he immediately realized there wasn't. And that was the end of it. He was not taking drugs to get away. He was trying to help you and me, and as he often did, try to find things that would be of help to the alcoholics behind him. Well, that's the end of the LSD surge for a couple of years to hit the street. Then in my time, I got a job, finally. And I was about 2 years old, I got a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. And I still didn't have any front teeth, but I learned to carry my lip like this. Nobody thought I did my front teeth that had been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day, and I had a harsh sponsor insist that I go to work and so on. But while I was working in this medical corporation, I happened to be there, and to the best of my knowledge, the first advertising for the treatment of alcoholism ever took place in a medical magazine. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, I was in, "Physicians, at last you can treat your problem drinkers and alcoholics." And I read that, but God, if I only would have hung on another couple of years, I wouldn't have to go to all these meetings. And there was this new drug, and it just had a smack of freedom, which was called Librium. And I thought, wonderful, I wish I had got that. Of course, a few months later, the first Librium survivors came back to the meetings. But I haven't drank. Then from then on, there was just a series of little tests. Later, I did a job. In the mid-60s, I was working. I moved to KHJ, where another guy and I created this thing called Boss Radio, which became number one hard rock station in the world. Then I moved to television, and I was slick by now, and I had front teeth. Or something, in case you're new here, if you're new, I don't know what the hell you're doing, you're anything, but if you are, once you become spiritually perfect, your teeth grow back. I looked at programs for the upcoming week, and I was in charge of promotion then, and the things I had to promote was one, a speaker who came to discuss how alcoholics have been returned to social drinking. I didn't really want to return to social drinking by that time, but I was interested in proving the old timers wrong, and it turned out this guy was a representative of Sheikh Shadel Hospital in Seattle. And Sheikh Shadel Hospital had isolated some things that if you took them and redressed your body's imbalance, alcoholics could drink again. And I thought, this is ridiculous. How can this be? But I'll tell you, I went down and stood behind the camera and watched this guy, I'll tell you. And he gave a little talk on it. At the end, he said, "You know this, I'm the director of the program," he said. "And they say alcoholics can't do this." And he lifted up a martini and drank it. And I didn't even want the martini, but my tongue went. It's a conditioned reflex. I thought, God, isn't that something? But about a month later, apparently, this guy's imbalance came back because he wound up in a padded cell at Sheikh Shadel, and 2 weeks after that they stopped their program of returning alcoholics to social drinking, and they begrudgingly went back to abstinence. But for a while it looked like a great opening for a lot of people. In the late 1960s, I was coming out here this weekend, I remember this, over here in Redlands, I think it's Redlands, where White Memorial Hospital is, big Seventh-day Adventist hospital. And they got about a page and a half of ink in the LA Times on how they had stopped drunkards from drinking. No AA, no nothing, just an excellent therapy. And I read that with awe, and what they had done, you know, they're deaf on drinking, but they had taken one of their wards and turned it into a bar. A regular bar with a bartender in the back bar. And these poor sick boobs would come in there the first day, you know. The bartender, come on, drink, pal. She said, you're going to give me some of that medicine out that makes me sick. Not at all. I swear, just like it is. Okay, we need a building, huh? We give it a shot in a glass, put a cord down, I guess, so that they wouldn't take the glass away with them. Yeah, one more, one here, they don't get it. You guys, you know, you sons of elders, are the free alcoholics, I'm here. And every day, the guys came back for a few drinks. God, what a wonderful, you know. And one day, they came and had a little drink. As they took a drink, they shoot the electric shock through that cord. Hold the ice next time, Fred. Then they give them a drink without it. That's more like a broccoli if you do it. The poor groups after that, they're just like fawns in a forest fire. They just didn't... They just never knew. Finally, they come in and say, you want a little drink? No, I don't believe I do. And they did that for 5 days, a week, they were cured. And they released them, and they had nothing but cures. It was wonderful. And the Times wrote this long article. It wasn't a year later that somebody did a follow-up on them, and they're all drunk. And most of them hadn't got beyond the first bar, they didn't have a cord on their wall. So, it was just hell. Then the next big item in the treatment of alcoholics, as I recall, most older people remember this. So this is in the early 1970s. Big headlines in the paper. Rand report. Alcoholics can return to drinking. Of course, they have a little squib in there, except those that can't. We know who they are. And they didn't want to make the mistake they made at White Memorial, so they didn't follow up. They didn't. First weekly and then monthly follow-up, so there wouldn't be any of this. And they had all sorts of people all over the country who would return to social drinking. And about 2 years later, 3 years later, a doctor in North Carolina did a follow-up on them. And he found out most of them were drunk. Because all of them. I knew a guy who ran a couple of companies. I said, we were in Santa Monica. I said, how did you do your follow-up? Of course, I thought you'd done something effective. Now it turns out it was all a big scam. Not a scam, but a mistake. He said, I can't understand it. We called him and asked him, you know, is he some boob somewhere? Yeah, still okay. Then there was one of the things I enjoyed reading about in the 19... Oh, first, another thing I forgot, completely the big cure for alcohol usage and abuse in the early 1950s. A drug that you can give to drinkers and they won't drink because it makes them sick. And this, now that's a perfect answer to drug. Take this and you won't get sick. Wives were known to put it in people's food surreptitiously just to teach the dirty bastards a lesson. Eat your food, Fred. But nobody can understand why that didn't work. Nobody can understand why that didn't work. And obviously the reason it didn't work is because when these moral degenerates insisted on drinking, they forgot to take their antabuse, that's all. Didn't take their antabuse. They still sell antabuse as the answer to drinking problems. And it still is ineffectual. But in the 1970s, there was a doctor in New Mexico, I love reading about him, who, you'd bring a guy there dead drunk, and he'd take movies of you. Then, 2 weeks later, when you decide you want to drink again, they'd bring you to his office, and you'd run these movies. Say, is this where you want to be? No, I don't. And then unfortunately after that, some of the guys didn't have time to go to the movies on the way to a bar, you know.
I've seen that movie, never mind.
Then we had a rash of all kinds of cures and things, and it goes on and on. There's still a movement now where you can return to social drinking, the same old tedious arguments, just little ways to do it. And it's always a baffling thing because people can't understand why people don't respond to this. But look at your watch, Keith. It's almost 2:30.
Almost time for the important thing to play on the pool.
There are some lives I'm sorry I saved.
Not yours, I mean some over there.
But again and again, and even today, the problems continue. I see them again and again. And people kind of understand why they don't respond. And people still come to Alcoholics Anonymous when all else has failed. And they can't make it here. And it's the same story all over the world. Of people like you and me, who once upon a time Dr. Yu said that the only way for people like you and me to live without drinking, as he told Roland, there seem to be had two ways. You can either keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live, or else you must almost certainly intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. And Roland said, is there no other way out? He said, yes. There have been a few cases I've never seen, I've heard on the literature, where there's been some significant involuntary psychological inversion that they call some sort of a spiritual experience that literally changes their perception. But he said they're so rare, it's almost the millions of cases I don't know of too. And it turned out that of all things, that through the series of funny little events, this no low-down, jobless, bum, gigolo wife, living off his wife guy in Brooklyn named Bill Wilson, had one of those spiritual experiences, and eventually after they had evolved some way to stay sober by helping others, and they wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Incidentally, it's kind of an interesting thing. The first printing, if you ever see a big red book, you'll see something that's not in any book after that. It said, step 12 reads, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And of course, the members then came up to Bill and said, how can that be, Bill? We haven't had any spiritual experience. You don't have had a spiritual experience. And you didn't have this result of these steps. You had it in Tom's Hospital 4 years before you thought of the steps. How do you explain that? And he couldn't explain it. They thought about that a long time. Frankly, the book sold so slowly they didn't have to make any quick answers, you know. And that's, I think, what has evolved into understanding that particular point is what makes Alcoholics Anonymous what it is. Alcoholics Anonymous is full of people, I believe, who come here knowing that there's no therapy here that can help them. Because it always goes back to the same thing. They want me to stop drinking, and it helps a lot of people, but it doesn't help me. It helps me a little bit. I don't vomit. I can get a job for a while. That has been said by all our speakers, and will be said again. Eventually, it gets so bad that I can't stand it. My problem is not alcohol. If there's a flag that people like me will carry all my life, I've often thought I'd like to be the Betsy Ross of Alcoholics Anonymous and design a flag we could all gather under. And it wouldn't say, I need booze. It would say, but you don't understand. March on Washington and demand our rights. Except the way we are, we'd all wind up in Seattle and say, well, who do we talk to here now? Yeah.
I look at my life and I thought I was quite bright and I had fairly good jobs. And I came to AA time after time for 10 years. And I wanted for it to work. But it became obvious to me after a year or two. AA doesn't work for people like me. Because my problem is not really alcohol. It looks like it is when I'm drunk, but it isn't. My problem is I'm secretly inadequate. And I have to pretend I'm not. My problem is I don't think people really like me. My problem is I've been hurt a lot by others. My problem is I'm too vulnerable. I try to disguise it. My problem is I just don't feel like I'm enough. And when people get too close to me, they can see that, and then they don't like me. And for people like me, it's almost impossible to have any close relationship because you can't dare let them see what you really are. So you have to keep them at a distance. And I discovered when I was a boy 15 years old on a ship in the South Pacific, and thereafter, that if you don't vomit up the alcohol and you can breathe, this makes things look all different. When I drink, I feel like I'm enough. More than enough, sometimes. When I drink, I don't feel vulnerable. I feel invulnerable sometimes. I don't feel afraid. I don't feel rejected. I don't get my feelings hurt much. I hurt people's feelings. If people hurt my feelings, go outside and fight, you son of a bitch. I would never do that sober. And it makes me feel like I'm suffering. It makes me feel the way other people look. I understand that thing from, you know, the journalistic alcohol studies. It changes my psychological profile. And it turns out I didn't know this for a long time, but that is what makes an alcoholic. People always wonder, did I really go to jail enough to be an alcoholic? Did I go to the meth house enough to be an alcoholic? You hear all these garish stories, after a while you just wonder what it all means. How can you be an alcoholic? But a real alcoholic, I didn't draw a sober breath for 25 years. That's an alcoholic. That guy's got a problem. Or you hear these crazy guys, now I escaped from San Quentin, great call nuns, and then I went bad after that. How could I be an alcoholic? My problem isn't like that. I'm not that way. And probably the greatest enemy of sobriety, it seems to me, is that the innate pattern of people like me, and I presume like you, is to measure my alcoholism by what it has done to me. And that's really just a side effect. That is absolutely irrelevant. But sometimes it's enough to make you check that you're where you are. That's the only value of it. It turns out, as we all know, that alcoholics are measured by what alcohol does for you. That's what makes an alcoholic. But unless it does something special for you, it will never do anything to you. Because if it starts doing something to you, you quit. But if it's doing something special for you, you've got to take that, the thing with it, and hopefully it won't be so bad. That little paragraph in chapter 3 that we read sometimes, we read chapter 3, so kind of fun, and sometimes people laugh when they read it. We changed from scotch to brandy. We drank only wine. We only drank at home. We never drank at home. We swore off people without a sour mouth. We read spiritual literature. We took trips. We didn't take trips. On and on. It is that funny. But I'm sure that everyone in this room that's an alcoholic has done these things. Maybe not the specific things, but things like it. And that's why they put at the end of that paragraph, we could increase this list ad infinitum, which means forever. Now, what would that list be covering? It covers people like me, and I presume like you, when alcohol that has enabled me to feel like something on a continuing basis now has become a problem, and sometimes a severe problem. And so I quit drinking, and I realized that was not, now I'm back to the problem. It's like having an abscess tooth and swore off Novocaine. It's just, and it just makes you crazy. It's just amazing how perceptive that book was when he wrote it, because he didn't know it correct. One of the things like, there seems to be a point that there's no adequate defense against the first drink. And I've been doing many times, and most of the people in this room have. That's not my problem, and you don't understand. I go to AA, and it seems to me they're saying, if you get sober, you'll feel better. And that's why I always knew I couldn't be a real alcoholic. Because I drink like an alcoholic, I get in trouble like an alcoholic, but the problem is this. Unlike alcoholics, when I get sober and clean of my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And that's when all those feelings come back little by little. And I'm not able to sustain anything. I mean, one-to-one relationship. I used to look back after I was sober a while and think, why have I never been able to sustain a one-to-one relationship with anybody? And I can look back and it became quite clear. I've seen it in many other people since then. When you have nothing inside of you, no self-worth to speak of, you must get whatever worth you get from other people, from their eyes and from their attention. So you wind up in the I wind up in a situation, it sounds funny, but it's really pathetic. Right, anytime I have a close one-to-one relationship, I've had much of my life, all I ask of you, just treat me special all the time. And if you treat me special, I feel average. And if you treat me average, I feel rejected. And there's nobody in the world that's going to treat you special all the time. After all, sometimes just the mere fact of accepting you gets you more, you know, more informal. But that, to me, that means they don't like me anymore. I didn't like you anyway, now that I think about it. Yeah, and on and on. I just see people who sit and drink with other people for the life that I've... People like me are bar drinkers. When this bar gets where they don't treat me special anymore, I go to the next bar. And the next group, and the next love, and the next... And never knowing there was no possible answer for my problem. But here now, I got an answer, alcohol which works, and now they're telling me I can't do that. So I give them that paragraph. Why? What does that paragraph mean? The paragraph means... I realize I can't stay sober, so I'm going to try to find a way to drink without the problem. I'm going to just drink wine, maybe. I just, 2 years ago, I was sent to the office, sent me over to KGIR, there's one of the stations, to do a public service radio program. A guy wanted to interview me for AA, my name on the program is Alcoholic Al. And I talked a little bit about alcoholism. And this woman called up from Laguna Beach, who knew what this time, she said, and she had a very cultured voice. She said, I don't know if you ever had a case like this. She said, but I seem to have some form of drinking problem with my wines. She said, I just drink wines, and very fine wines, but they almost become addictive. Have you ever heard of anything like that? I said, yes, madam, we call that a wino. She made a noise like a dial tone, the damnedest thing. But you get to this problem now. And now there's a name for this condition. It is called alcoholism of our type. You no longer can drink with impunity, and you can't stay sober. And there you are. You stay sober as long as you can till you have to drink. And you drink till you have to get sober. And you stay sober till you have to drink. And you drink till you have to stay sober. Alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, it is estimated by some people that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk as a direct result of drinking. And I'm sure this is an average meeting, a very average meeting of alcoholics, maybe upper scale alcoholics. I think it's safe to say the number of people in this room will die drunk. Not today, it doesn't work, not today, not an answer. But somewhere along the line, it would seem no longer necessary to apply the answer. And little by little, I revert to an untenable sobriety. That's one of the great reasons for meetings today. You know, meetings were originally started, the first meetings, as I understand it, so they could take a newcomer somewhere and they could see actual sober alcoholics, because there's no place else in the world you could do that. And little by little, meetings have continue to do that, but it's evolved in something much different when we go and get spiritual reinforcement. And one of the great things we learn here, if you stay here a while, that's why it's so good, it really helps you to be desperate when you come here, because you may lower some of your defenses against what you do. And so it turns out that Alcoholics Anonymous has this strange set of therapies which are not anywhere near as good as other therapies are, and they seem to be strange because They don't deal with the problem of my emotions. When I have emotional problems, I want to go talk to someone who is skillful and trained in dealing with emotional problems. A psychiatrist, a psychologist. I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars in my life on psychotherapy and trying to find an answer to these problems. Now that's where you go to have emotional problems. Maybe go to A for vision, but these are emotional problems. And it just seems strange that these trained people, they have an answer. They say, you come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change and you'll live better. And AA, these well-meaning amateurs, they mean well, they're nice people, no. But they're not very good at what they do, apparently. You come to us, and we'll change your actions, and your thinking will get better. No, you don't understand. And what helps you if you can stay here a little while is to one day stumble upon the most amazing fact. These amateurs have 10,000 rooms full of sober alcoholics all over the world, and the doctors do not have one. But it takes a while to understand that. And that's why the desperation helps here, because it can impel you to take actions. A couple months ago, I was talking up in Toronto. They had a question and answer, And you probably would never guess this, but I have a tendency to talk a lot. And they ask me questions, and my answer, when somebody asks me a question that's difficult, I talk for a few minutes while I think of the answer. And this woman in the back of the room, God, she was a bad one. She said, if you don't mind, I wouldn't want one of your long answers. She said, can you put in a short, just a sentence or two? You slept for 10 years and now you're sober almost 40 years. What was the difference this time? And I couldn't think of the answer in a sentence or two. I was going to simulate a heart attack, but I didn't. Time's up. Well, that's not sorry, man. But I thought about it in the shower. I thought about that then. I was giving a talk, and I thought, it's such a simple thing that sounds so odd to complex imitation intellectuals like me that I'm new. This is the first time that I took actions I did not agree with and that I thought were stupid. That doesn't sound like much, does it? But everybody comes to me to talk about action. I'll be glad to take any action as long as I agree with it. It makes sense. And it turns out those are not the actions that change your life. The actions that change your life are the actions that don't. The classic case of the sponsor said, now, you've got this terrible depression. I want you to take this action. And you don't say anything, but your head just goes off. You don't understand. I know you mean well, and I know you're trying to help me, but you can't possibly know me as well as I know me. And that sort of thing just makes me worse. You just don't understand. That can't work, you think. And then they do it. And that is the difference between staying somewhere, whether or not, after all that, you go take the action. Remember the day that I lost my job as a dishwasher for Gaiety Delicatessen 6 months later? And I determined to kill myself. And my sponsor said, take your inventory. And I just told him the week before, I've taken my inventory to the psychiatrist. I want to see an out-of-work actor, for Christ's sake. What good that would do? And it never made him testy. It never made him testy. And I said, taking inventory doesn't help me. It makes me more depressed. In my judgment, that doesn't help. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment? So Christ, what's your judgment? Because I'm living in the back seat of an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. I want your judgment to put the head in the back window and ask you for it. And I took an inventory and I put stuff in there I never told anybody. And this letter had me right in the car, the auctioneer, and I read it with a flashlight. And 2 weeks after that, I was sitting at meetings with 6,200 club saying, I don't know how you can expect to stay sober unless you're willing to have an inventory the way you said. But this AA thing consisting of actions, that's all you have to do is take actions. You don't have to believe in anything much, because the actions, it turns out, they don't care who takes them. But little by little, they bring about sobriety. Now, what is this sobriety they bring about? How can that be? These dumb little actions. Because it turns out, I think, it took a while after they questioned Bill, I think it comes a little feeling, and they have a much greater feeling now. What is the purpose of this text now called Alcoholics Anonymous? If you have to have a spiritual experience, only Bill had it. How can other people stay sober? I believe it to be correct, I bet my life on it, that Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of AA in some way that are still puzzling, but not puzzling that, the steps of AA do something that nothing else has done in the history of the treatment of alcoholism in the history of the world. They bring about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson had his, but the way we get ours. Make a mess of that bitch. And what happens, it brings it out. What it brings about is the same, I believe the purpose of AA, because some newcomer said, well, why are you still active after 40 years? Why is Harvey Andrews still going to meetings after 40 years? How sober can you get? Now, it isn't you get you sober. You get sober in the first week. The point is that from then on, I have to do things that will change, that will replace alcohol. And what alcohol does for me, it alters my perception of reality. And now it seems quite clear. That is what Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do. To alter my perception of reality. And left to myself, I'm rather intense and I have strong emotions. Psychiatrist once said I'd have to take medications all my life because of the intensity of my emotions. But somehow here, in doing these things and redressing this imbalance on a continual basis by going to meetings or trying to move up somehow to others, it has brought about a change of perception. I believe that the purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol does fast. It takes a person like me who never felt like I'm enough. And today, much of the time, I feel like I'm enough. Sometimes I don't. That used to bother me. What do I feel like I'm enough all the time? I'm doing the best I can. It turns out no human being feels like they're enough all the time. That's just part of being a human being. It takes a person like me who's lived with fear all my life, fear of exposure, fear of danger, fear of envy. But the way I find myself, not much in time I'm not afraid. Some of you know, two or three times the last year, I've gone down alleys on Skid Row where the police do not choose to go down with drawn guns and under that mouth to pull some son of a bitch out. People say, oh, Clancy, you're so fearless. I'm not, I don't know how to do that. I am not crazy because if I was sitting at home in my living room with my wife Charlotte, and that would be her threatening noise in the backyard, I'd send her to see what it was. Because it might be a boogeyman. And if it is a boogeyman, I'm more afraid of Al-Anon than it is. Well, even boogeymen can't stand up with that cold smile. But there's a person like me that has a great deal of difficulty sustaining relationships. I've been able to sustain some relationships. And so in the second printing of the book, and ever since then, the only step they've changed is the 12th step. It now says, as we all know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. And in so doing, we bring about a spiritual experience. And once you get that spiritual experience, that doesn't mean that you're going to keep it. Because even Bill Wilson had the spiritual experience at the age of 6 months, he was ready to quit. Because he had no luck with drinkers. And so it says in our book, again wisely, our sobriety seems to be based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Based on what? Internal prayer? Some prayer. Some meditation. More primarily, being of service. I don't know a better way to describe how to maintain that limited change of perception that has given me that's enabled me to live in the world with some degree of peace when nothing else in my life has ever done it. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. In 1950, the first international convention, they brought all these people together, tried to sell them the traditions, and try to get them to understand that they're all alike, not to hate each other as they were doing. And on Friday night, Saturday afternoon, I should say, Dr. Bob was brought to the podium dying of cancer. He He had to be helped with her, but he wanted so much to convey what he had found. And he had, and he, I got tapes of that, very touching. Got a photograph of it, actually. And he said, and he says, he starts off, I said, well, you must pardon me, my health hasn't been quite as much, because I've been dead much of the last few months. He said, well, I want to welcome you, boys and girls, from all the people, from other people back home. But then he synthesized, he wanted to convey what he learned, he converted it in 3 points. And to me, it had always been the absolute germ of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I would be indeed remiss if I didn't try to pass along a couple of things that might be of interest. One, let us keep our program simple. Let us not lust at all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. And reduced to the end, our work here consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding and love. And just between you and me, there's a person in this room that doesn't need to hear that on a continuing basis, because that tongue, when you're having a bad day, just, or when you feel bad or something threatens you. But just remember that. Try. The good thing about it is when you fail today, you can try again tomorrow. And thirdly, he said, let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we don't have time to help the man behind us. Give him a pat on the back when he needs it. To take him to a few meetings, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. And then he thanked the people and he sat down and he died shortly thereafter. And to me, as I look at that, it's always been, always brings tears to my eyes as I think about that guy in terrible pain, being helped to the point to say those things that I need to hear so desperately on a continual basis. And I don't know. And what's the point of the law? To make you wonderful, to be better than humans? Not at all. So that you and I can maintain a changed perception of reality, so that we need never drink, we need never try to kill ourselves, we need never run, we need never escape again. But we can live here. At the end of the long form of the 12th tradition says, just to the end that our great blessings may never spoil us, to be sure, forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Thank you.